This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 74 of What's It Like. My guest is Aaron Fulkerson, somewhere in San Diego. Hey, Aaron.
Hi, how's it going tonight?
I'm doing good. So did you grow up in that area?
No, I'm currently in Mission Hills, where I live with my wife and two children. But I grew up in the Bay Area, Morgan Hill, actually, which was really rural when I grew up there, and now is basically a suburb of San Jose.
Oh. So did you come from a large family?
No, I've got a brother and sister, and so, you know, 2.5, I guess.
Right in the average, huh?
Yeah.
So who had the biggest influence on your life when you were growing up?
Well, you know, I had a grandfather who was on my adopted father's side, who was very influential and had me very interested in metaphysics and philosophy and religion when I was young, you know, 10, 12 years old. So he was really influential. You know, he had me read W. Severson Maugham's The Razor's Edge. Had me interested in ethics and world religions and philosophy. So he was pretty influential. My mother was pretty influential because she was, you know, so entrepreneurial and high energy. So she was probably pretty influential too. Yeah, both my parents, I should say.
What was your major challenge as a child?
Oh, you know, I was pretty high energy to a fault. So, you know, growing up, it was difficult to, I guess, fit in for that reason. So, you know, I got in a lot of trouble growing up as a kid, and it was mostly just, you know, lots of energy.
Is there a particular childhood experience, do you think, that has contributed most to who you are today?
I don't know if I can identify a singular one. I remember there's kind of an amalgamation of events that has contributed significantly to who I am today. I mean, on one side, there's when I started my first business when I was in the fourth grade, and I made a homemade glue that was edible and sold it to fourth graders, and it was a short-lived fad. But you know, that's like one of several events that I realized how much I loved just like, you know, product and selling product. You know, I mean, I love making product, you know, that's why I went into engineering. But I remember also I'd visit my grandfather in Florida, and I would just like pitch people as I'm talking 8, 9, 10 years old, whatever. I'd just pitch people that to complete strangers. And it was kind of like my first business when I was in the fourth grade, you know, where I was basically pitching people. But then the other side of it was, you know, I got exposed very early to philosophy, Buddhism in particular. And that's something that really resonated with me at a really young age. And I got really fascinated with, like, you know, mythology, Joseph Campbell, and psychology. And there's kind of two things. One, where I was really interested in metaphysics and epistemology, and then on the other side of it, I really am passionate about like starting things and business. You know, so there's kind of two things that were confluence of events. I wouldn't pick like one individual one.
Mm-hmm. Are you a practicing Buddhist now?
No, I don't know. I mean, I think mostly, probably, yeah. I suppose so, yeah.
You're not sure?
Yeah, I mean...
Well, metaphysics is like that. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think if I align with any organized philosophy or religion, it's definitely Buddhism more than any other, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Aside from selling edible glue, what was school like for you?
It was really tough. Mm. Really challenging for me. I had a lot of difficulty all the way through school. You know, I graduated high school with a 1.67 GPA.
But you made it through.
Yeah. Most people, when I tell them that, respond with, I didn't know you could graduate with a 1.67. And evidently you can, but I don't think you can with a 1.66.
But you went on from there to do a variety of things.
Yeah, so I kind of, from there, I became what probably previous generations would call a Dharma bum, and the current generation would call an anarchist.
Or at least an explorer.
Yeah, so, you know, I kind of hit the road and did that for a few years, and did a lot of backpacking, hitchhiking, canoeing, camping. You know, I was living very much, you know, I'd cook, and, travel and cook and travel and really love that. And then I met my wife in northern Minnesota of all places. And, she was graduating with her degree in elementary education.
How did you meet her?
Oh, I was applying for a job at a country club and, as a sous chef. And I'd actually come out of the woods. I had not worked for months. And, you know, I didn't have any money. I had a $200 car, but didn't have gas money. So I walked to the interview, and I was sitting down with the executive chef at this at Northland Country Club in Duluth, Minnesota. And, you know, really hit it off with the executive chef. And this woman walked in, and she looked at me, and I looked at her, and she walked right up to me in the middle of the interview, and she started hitting on me in the middle of the interview or talking to me. And that was 15 years, 2 months, and seven days ago. So her and I became really good friends, and she graduated about a year later with her undergraduate degree, and we backpacked together a little bit, and then I said that I should probably get in school, and she said, well, what are you going to do? And I was like, well, you know, I think I want to do something in, like, history or philosophy, you know, really dig into metaphysics and epistemology, and Duke University's got a great program, and so I considered doing that. And then I was like, well, you know, what else I really like is this whole internet thing is really exciting. And I grew up programming as a kid. I was, would write code. Really enjoyed doing that. And really, I always had a passion for mathematics, in fact. So I was like, well, you know, maybe I should do this whole computer science track. And it was then I realized that Chapel Hill in North Carolina, just about, I guess, 8 or 10 miles away from Duke, had one of the top 10 computer science programs in the world. And I said, you know what, let's just go to North Carolina, and I'll enroll at Chapel Hill. And she said that my wife Tara said that, well, you know, it's they. I did some research, and they only accept about 15% of their applicants. I was like, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. So 2 days later, we drove down, and she got a job there, and I got a job a little bit after that, cooking, and then. You know, I started at the junior college in Durham Technical Community College, and by way of seeing how challenged Tara's students were, she was teaching elementary school, and there in Durham, and it was an underserved Title I school with at-risk kids. It was really rough. I saw just, you know, these kids. It was interesting. I realized that they would live their life within a 15-mile radius. Area. And they really would never leave that area. And it was very cyclical. So I thought that was really interesting. And I thought, well, I wonder what would happen if I exposed these kids to other cultures and other places. And I'll use the internet to do it. So I helped Tara set up a computer lab in her school, CC Spalding. It was a Title I magnet school there in Durham. And I started helped to start some nonprofits with the first community center in our school, and then we spread to other public housing communities that have rec rooms. I started getting computers from a variety of different sources, corporations that were giving them away because they were cycling them out because, you know, oh, wow, these are, you know, 2 years old or 3 years old and we need to upgrade. So in all, I set up 16 community centers. And what I realized was that a lot of the violence within these communities ran along gang lines that are drawn around the public housing communities. So I realized that, well, if I can get these kids to work on projects together across the different public housing communities, we would probably make friends with these people and prevent violence. And that's exactly what we did. So I started busing them from the different public housing communities to other, basically putting them in a bag, shaking them up, and then making them work on projects together that involve technology, right? You know, mostly at first they wanted to just like go to the 50 Cent website. But, you know, once they realize that, no, if they'll be able to do that after they do the structured lesson and work collaboratively with each other. Well, what ended up happening was it was a big success. We drove down violent crimes by, it was like, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20%. I don't remember exactly, wherever our community centers were. So that was a big success. And then the other thing that we did was we said, well, how do we connect with the parents? Because I would literally have 2-year-olds that would get on our buses. Well, they were church vans. I partnered with the local churches to get transportation. I would literally have 2-year-olds that would wander into my labs with no parents, no older siblings. They're just walking around the public housing communities that were really rough and, you know, violence and drugs and whatnot. So I was like, man, I got to find a way to connect with the parents. So I was like, well, how can I do that? And the only thing we had was we had a ton of computers, right? So what we started doing was we'd get the parents to come into classes to learn how to rebuild the computers and learn how to use them. And then we'd give them a computer at the end of the class, so they'd have to get education. So that was a big success too, and a bunch of them, or several of them that I knew of in the short period that I was there for, I guess, about 3 years. You know, they started going to Durham Technical Community College as well. So anyway, I did that for a little bit, and gratefully managed to get the Jack Kent Cook Scholarship, which is the largest scholarship in the United States. And then, of course, I had kind of the red carpet treatment at Chapel Hill. So that's kind of my education college experience.
So what exactly do you do?
Well, you know, I guess to keep with the chronology, I was recruited out of college to work at Microsoft in a pretty prestigious small research team that reported to one of the CTOs. There was about 14 people in the team, and we were researching distributed systems. So, you know, how do you deal with like highly concurrent systems? So we did. It was heavy mathematics, really fun stuff. And I worked with. I had the good fortune of working with people like Chuck Thacker, who did the first graphical user interface at Xerox PARC, which was, you know, of course, adapted by Mac, by Apple with the Mac, and of course Windows by Microsoft. And other people too that were in that 14-person team. I just completely got lucky. I mean, I'm just lucky.
You were a programmer there?
I was a program manager. So I helped them to capture their collective knowledge and then disseminate it through the rest of Microsoft. So I was there for that was 2003, and I met my co-founder of MindTouch, which is the company that I'm one of the founders and the CEO of, and his name's Steve Bjorg. We met there, and what we realized was there weren't any good technologies for capturing knowledge and disseminating it. You know, I was really struggling with it at Microsoft, and you know, SharePoint didn't really see, it's really focused on files and stuff, so it didn't work well. So what I wanted to do, I had some ideas about having an environment that was collaborative for authoring content and publishing content, but my approach was all wrong. And I talked to Steve, my co-founder, about it. He's like, yeah, that's a great idea, but what it should look like is it should look a lot like a wiki. And a wiki is kind of a really simple website that anybody can edit. You know, Wikipedia, of course.
Right.
So I thought, wow, that's a great idea for what the user experience metaphor should look like. And I said, well, he suggested, well, let's do a company about this. You know, I was like, that sounds like a great idea. So we started MindTouch. And we started MindTouch in 2005, and originally we released it as an open source project, which means that we put the source code out there for anybody to use, kind of like Linux or the Firefox browser. They're both open source. And we launched the project in 2006, and then, you know, we released the source code and launched an open source community. People could submit back code or, you know, bug fixes, you know, bugs or whatever, you know. And by a year later, it was the number four most popular open source project in the world out of 300,000 of them, as was ranked by SourceForge.net, which was at that time the only and definitive source for open source projects. That's where everybody went back then in 07. So, you know, within a very short period of time, it became this incredibly popular open source project that is now used by tens of millions of people.
How did you start the company? Was it an expensive project, or did you just guys get together and make it out of thin air?
No, we bootstrapped it, so it wasn't like a venture capital back where we raised like $25 million, and you know that's not how we approached it. We originally approached it with there was about I guess from the beginning four of us mm-hmm. in 2005. And, you know, we focused on just shipping the product. And then for the next year, you know, we decided, well, instead of selling it, let's just get it out there and see if people think it's as important as we do. And clearly they did, because suddenly we were doing thousands of downloads a day. And then in 2008, you know, there was about six or – I guess there was probably – probably maybe six to eight of us or something. And I decided, well, gosh, you know, I was like, man, you know, there's a lot of people using this. We should sell something. So I got on the phone and started calling people that had installed it and suggested that, hey, you know, you should probably buy support. And, you know, our 2008, we made our first $1 million. And, you know, then we started adding salespeople and marketing people, and then we became really focused on one particular use case instead of this kind of like broad category of, you know, enterprise collaboration. We became really focused on, well, technology companies and helping them to help their end users understand how to use their products better. Mm. You know, we got pulled in the direction because so many of our customers and users were already using us for this, like Intuit and PayPal and, you know, Mozilla, the makers of Firefox, and Intel, Microsoft, you know, all these big technology companies were using us for just delivering better product help and technical documentation. So instead of here's your PDF and it's exactly the print manual, it's something that's much more dynamic, web ready, social. And, you know, and by 2009, that's really what we focused on. And, you know, we've done really well by focusing on that particular use case. It's a real problem for companies.
Mm-hmm. What's the best thing about your job?
The people I work with. Yeah. I mean, I love my work. I love what I do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely the people I work with. People are fascinating, and you know, it's really amazing to help build a product, see that product just take off with tens of millions of users, and whoa, that was amazing. And then see people spend lots of money for that product, and mm-hmm. you know, really change fundamentally how they do certain aspects of their business. That's a lot of fun, you know, but really it's the people, it's the customers, it's the people. It's not just the people I work with. When I say the people I work with, that's customers too. Yeah, that's really the best thing, is just being able to have so many interactions with so many different people. It's something that I've always learned a great deal from, probably because I'm so extroverted. You know, I verbalize everything. That's how I think through problems, is by verbalizing it. So, You know, I think that, yeah, people.
Let me turn the question around. What's the worst thing about your job?
People. No, I mean, making hard decisions that affect people. That's certainly the worst part of it. You know, there's times when your coworkers aren't the best fit for the company, and you have to make tough decisions about that. There's times when I've made mistakes by giving people that I work with too much autonomy, because that's what I thrive with, is autonomy and independence. And that's the kind of environment I thrive in. But not everybody thrives in that environment. And, you know, that's you know, been one of my biggest mistakes and one of my biggest lessons over the last couple of years is, you know, I remember when I ran restaurants. And, you know, I grew up, my parents owned restaurants, and I grew up in restaurants. Heck, I was running one when I was 15 by myself. So I would never, ever imagine giving autonomy inside that environment. Because, you know, it's just that they're low-wage employees. It's not like a career for them, right? So it's just a job. It doesn't really matter to them. Nobody cares as much as you do when you're the owner, right? I would never, ever imagine giving them autonomy. And it's interesting how similar. Business is business, right? It's the same. It doesn't matter if you're running a restaurant or running a software company. It's fundamentally the same. And that's one of the things I've learned over the last couple of years is, you have to be careful with people just because you give them too much independence and it scares them.
Yeah, everyone's different.
Yeah. So to go back to your question, what's the worst thing about it is the worst thing is having to make hard decisions that affect people.
What type of person would be good at your job?
Oh, as a CEO or entrepreneur? Mm-hmm. Somebody who is pathologically optimistic. somebody who is just, you have to be really confident. You have to be really, really confident. And if you're, it's like when they analyze athletes and those who think that they're better than everybody else actually perform better. Well, I mean, that's true too with entrepreneurs, you know? Another thing I've learned over the years is you can't be too modest. Because people don't want you to be modest. People who report to you really don't want you to be modest. They want to have blind faith. And if you can't give them that that level of authority, of that level of confidence, then it frustrates and scares them. So, you know, pathological optimism, a great deal of self-confidence. You have to be able to... I'm not saying multitask because you never want to multitask, but you have to be able to focus on a lot of different things, meaning like focus on this thing through to completion, move to the next thing. So you have to be able to be very, very versatile with your skill set. I mean, gosh, in the very first days of MindTouch, I wrote a little bit of code. You know, my background's computer science, mm-hmm. right? I wrote a little bit of code in the early days of MindTouch, mostly like front end stuff, right? Then I did some product, a lot of product work, like, you know, designing, helping to design the product. Then I did a lot of community work and then marketing work. And the role just changes a lot, you know. So you really have to be versatile. I guess those are three big things right mm-hmm. there.
And work with other people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You have to be – I don't know that – I've known plenty of entrepreneurs that are pretty – poor managers. So it certainly helps a great deal to be a good manager. And it's something that I really, it's a skill I'm constantly studying up on. I would rank that probably below the other ones, to be honest. But if you're not a good manager, you better surround yourself with people that are.
Mm-hmm. If one wanted to, how would one get a job like yours?
Oh, you just have to, you know, you do it. You know, I mean, gosh, I've done so many businesses. I got, you know, my first one making edible glue gunk egg putting it in little silly putty eggs and selling it at school to taking wholesale pewter miniatures that I bought wholesale through mail order and then reselling them retail at different conventions to, I had a printing business. I had a web design business. I mean, all of these things I did, you just keep at it, you know, you keep at it and you have to be willing to fail, you know?
I have a great idea for a software product. How would I bring that to fruition?
The first thing is focus on the minimally viable product. Everybody thinks of like, oh, and then I can do this, and then it's gonna, you know, read people's minds, and then it's gonna solve world hunger, and then it's like, you know what? Just don't even worry about any of that nonsense. Focus on the minimally viable product. What's one or two features that you can bring to market? That's the first thing that people, I mean, that everybody, I had people approach me about this all the time. And consistently they go, oh, I want to do an iPad app for education. Gosh, you know, tell me more about that. Oh, that's a great idea. You know, you could really have a nice app that does this very simple thing and it would be very valuable and people would like to buy that. Oh, but wait, and then I'm going to do this and then it's going to control robots. And it's like, no, just minimally viable product, man. And I think that's the feeling of most people who try to be entrepreneurs is they don't focus on the first step. They focus on the end goal. They focus on the last step.
If there is such a thing, what's a typical day like for you?
Oh, I mean, it depends. You know, nowadays I do a lot of marketing, product messaging, product positioning. I like to be really involved with customers, so I'll jump on sales calls. I still do. I love jumping on sales calls with customers. I love it. I'll jump on support calls with customers that, you know, heck, sometimes we make mistakes and we have unhappy customers. Gratefully, it's not too often. In fact, I'm so proud of the fact that we have a 97% customer satisfaction score. So, you know, I mean, but if we do have an unhappy customer, I'll jump on a call and talk to them. I talk to a lot of journalists. I talk to a lot of analysts. I do a lot of writing. I do a lot of reading. I do a lot of one-on-ones with key stakeholders at MindTouch, the VP of sales, the marketing team, the VP of product, the VP of engineering, the head of support. I do a lot of one-on-one, you know, 30-minute meetings in a given week.
Are you up at 5 or more like 11?
No. I have two small children, so I'm up at typically 6. And I go to bed generally around midnight, asleep by like 1. So, thankfully I don't need much sleep.
Aaron, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Well, one of the things that I learned, I read a book called Spark, and it's about the neuroscience and exercise. And that's something that really changed me for the better, is I realized that if I exercise, I can become much more focused. And my office is about 4 miles away. I jog to work, or I bike to work. I try to exercise every single day. I really enjoy running long distances, like half marathons. I'm going to do an adventure marathon with my wife in Australia this year. But another thing that, to be honest, that I really enjoy is mosh pits. So punk rock concerts or very high energy mosh pits, that's good for my soul.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Exercise and mosh pits.
Same answer.
Honestly, it's totally true. It's the same answer. And I guess another thing that both relaxes me and energizes me is family time. You know, that's something that I'm a very, very active father and husband. When I'm home, I'm home. I'm focused. So, you know, nothing pleases me more than time with the kids and my wife.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
At least once a year. I mean, honestly, you know, yeah, at least once a year. I mean, gosh, you know, I mean, I've been homeless when I was younger. You know, I've been in some pretty tough spots when I was younger. Nowadays it's more about, you know, decisions I have to make that affect other people that make me, definitely feel challenged. I mean, honestly, I grew up an anarchist. I mean, literally that, government is, was something that was, not necessarily beneficial. Okay. And now I am the man, you know, I've become the man. And, that's something that it's taken me some time to get accustomed to. Mm-hmm. I've become accustomed to it for the sake of the people that I work for, meaning my employees, because I've realized that, you know, I have to make the hard decisions so that they don't have to.
Is there an idea or a principle that helps you through your challenges?
Yeah, I mean, Buddha Dharma, you know? Absolutely it does, you know? It's easy to lose sight of what's reality, you know? It's easy to begin to focus on achievements, right? The destination, instead of just really enjoying the journey, because my gosh, it's so much fun. When you can focus on just the journey, it's so wonderful. So yeah, I mean, for me, Buddha Dharma, absolutely. I mean, I think I'm just really lucky because I love my work. And I know people that I grew up with. I have a group of friends that we go back to kindergarten. I mean, elementary school. A couple of us, one good friend, kindergarten and elementary school. There's eight of us, right? And we all grew up in the Bay Area, and they're all very accomplished people. But, you know, these guys have jobs or maybe a career, but they don't have a calling. And, I mean, I feel like I have a calling. So it makes things much more enjoyable.
If you're giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say?
What I generally tell people is develop your ability to love and develop your ability to work. If you enjoy both, you're going to have a great life. And don't ever waste time doing stuff that you don't care about. Like if what you care about is, I don't know, worm farms, go do it. You know, don't worry about what you have for income. One of the things I've learned from being, I mean, like I said, you know, being dirt poor, even being homeless for a period, you really don't need much to live comfortably. And, you know, people get caught up in thinking that they need things that they don't really need. So just follow your passions, follow what you care about, and you'll be a lot happier.
You have to work with a lot of people. Do you have any favorite job interview questions that you use when selecting them?
Yeah. I love Tony Hsieh from Zappos' question about on a scale of 1 to 10, how lucky you are you? Because, you know, if they come back at you with like, oh, I'm a one, or I'm really unlucky, you know, either they're really pessimistic or they're really unlucky, which in either case, you don't want to work with them. So,
pretty good self-selector.
Yeah, another thing is, and I've had people tell me, oh man, I'm so unlucky. I'm like a one or a two. All right, interview over.
You're right. You're out of here.
So the other thing is that there's been research that shows that people who are consider themselves to be lucky just look for opportunity. They look for opportunities that other people don't look for. That's the difference between people who consider themselves to be lucky and people who who don't is that people who consider themselves to be lucky look for opportunities where others don't, and they'll find it. You know, I do a lot of logic puzzles just to hear how they think through things. Also, because that's how we did it at Microsoft. I ask them, what's something interesting about themselves? That's my standard question I ask every time. What's something interesting about yourself? And they'll be like, I'm a hard worker, blah, blah, blah. And I'll just call them, that's such a bullshit answer. And really, you got nothing? Well, you know, sometimes they'll be like, personal or professionally? And I'm like, I don't know. What do you think's interesting? And that's one of the best questions you can ask, because it tells you a lot about the person with how they answer that question. I always ask what their parents do. What do your parents do? What do they do? That tells me a lot, too. I'll tell you one thing is whenever I meet somebody who grew up in a family-owned restaurant, I hire them. It's worked out for me 100% of the time.
I want to thank Aaron Fulkerson for joining me today. Thanks, Aaron. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really enjoyed it.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.